The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
What's their track record been? I mean, when it comes to, you know, have the military commission shown that these judges can be trusted to appropriately grapple with important constitutional and statutory questions of first impression? Have they shown that the judges can be, you know, trusted to correctly anticipate what their appellate brethren are going to say if and when these issues get up to the appellate courts? The answers to both questions are resounding no's. And so we might be able to point to isolated episodes where the military commission trial judges have pushed back, especially when it's their convenience that's been implicated. But I don't know that anyone can point to the track record of the commissions as vindicating the claim of Judge Henderson's dissent and Judge Kavanaugh's concurrence in the en banc opinion last summer that we should let the military commission, that we should trust the military commissions. You know, if anything, whatever one thinks of the legality of the commissions, I don't know how you can look at the last 13 years as an exercise that should have built trust in anything other than that when these cases get to the D.C. Circuit, the government's actually going to lose more often than it wins.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 20th, 2015. That was Steve Vladek of both Lawfare and Just Security, and a professor at American University. On this week's Lawfare podcast, managing editor Wells Bennett invited Steve and Adam Thirschwell, an attorney with the Office of the Chief Defense Counsel of the Military Commissions, into the Lawfare studio to discuss the D.C. Circuit's decision vacating Ali Hamza Suleiman Abulul's conviction for inchoate conspiracy. The show takes a deep dive into the case and the court's opinion, ponders the future of the military commissions, and outlines what we can expect for the government to do next in the case. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 128, score one for Abulul.
Okay, gentlemen, thank you for joining us on the Lawfare Podcast. Abulul versus United States, a pretty big case from a three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit handed down last week. Here to discuss it with me are Steve Vladek of American University and Lawfare and Just Security, and Adam Thirschwell of the Office of Military Commissions. Steve, can you tell us what happened in this case? How did we get here? What brought us here, and then what happened?
It's a long, sordid path that got us to Friday. So this is actually now, I think, the third different time Abulul's case has been in the D.C. Circuit. It all started with a conviction in the military commissions about, seven years ago for conspiracy, for providing material support to terrorism, and for solicitation. Abulul subsequently appealed those convictions to the Court of Military Commission Review, which took a pretty long time to affirm the convictions in all respects. The case then came to the D.C. Circuit on a direct appeal under the Military Commissions Act. In between, the D.C. Circuit had held in the Hamdan case that the MCA didn't apply retroactively, that is to say, it didn't allow for trials of offenses that were committed before 2006 if the offense wasn't recognized as a war crime before 2006. So the original three-judge panel said, oh, well, there goes Abulul's convictions, and threw them out. The government then sought rehearing en banc in Abulul on that question. This provoked last summer's en banc ruling that Abulul had actually waived or forfeited his ex post facto objections to his three convictions. The Court of Appeals nevertheless held that even under plain error review, the highly deferential standard that applies when there is a waiver of a criminal defendant's substantive constitutional claims, two of those convictions, the ones for material support and solicitation, both had to be thrown out because it was plainly erroneous to hold that those didn't violate the ex post facto clause, but that the third conviction for conspiracy was not plainly erroneous. And then the Court of Appeals sent back to the original three-judge panel, Judges Henderson, Rogers, and Tatel, the other challenges Ballul had raised to his conspiracy conviction, including that it exceeded Congress's Article I power to make an inchoate conspiracy a standalone offense triable by a military commission. It violated Article III to have a domestic offense triable by a military commission. His conviction violates the First Amendment, and his conviction violates the equal protection principles of the Fifth Amendment. That's what went back to the D.C. Circuit panel. The case was argued in October of 2014, and on Friday we got the panel's ruling, which was a 2-1 decision, resting entirely on the Article III objection, and holding that, one, the Article III objection is reviewed de novo, insofar as it is jurisdictional, and two, under de novo review, Article III bars a non-Article III law of war military commission from entertaining criminal offenses that are not recognized by the international laws of war. So there's the nutshell explanation for how we got here, and I'm afraid to say that I suspect that we're only going to add to that long litany going forward.
That's about the right size nutshell, given the complexity of the procedural issues. Adam, this I guess is a question for you. If people are going to want to know, before we get into the legal weeds, what does this really change on the ground? If you're either from the standpoint of someone defending a detainee, or from the standpoint, to the extent you can sort of jump into the costume of your adversary, what does it change in terms of the government's prosecuting power? Because, you know, in some quarters this is viewed as like this bombshell ruling that spells the death of military commissions. But a lot of times we've had bombshell rulings that have spelled the death of military commissions, and somehow, some way, the military commissions yet persist.
They're so, like cockroaches.
Well, I mean, two answers or two aspects. The first is that this effectively vacates or potentially vacates three or four more of the convictions that have been achieved in the military commissions. There are a few that were the ones that were based solely on material support were already gone, thanks to the original Hamdan and then the original Ballul opinion. There were two or three, and I can never remember the exact number, who, however, were convicted of material support and conspiracy. Those now, a couple of them are up on appeal as it is, those are now out the window, along with the regular MST ones. And there's a reason why there are two or three of those, of the convictions, and that's really the only crimes that the government has been able to charge. The vast majority of the people who have been charged there are inchoate crimes. The main crime of most...
Let me stop you for 1 second there. I think most people would know what that means, but what does it mean to say inchoate crime?
An inchoate crime is really a crime that you planned on happening, that you tried to make happen, but that didn't actually occur. And so material support for terrorism says if you give money to a organization, a terrorist organization that has among its goals and its acts committing acts of terrorism, you're guilty of material support for terrorism, even though you did not personally commit any acts of terrorism, and you didn't even necessarily know of the particular acts that make it a terrorist organization. So, and conspiracy is the agreement to commit a crime. The crime doesn't have to happen. So that's, in a way, the classic inchoate crime. So what they have on most of the people there is membership in Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. And so they have, their theory for material support has been they were bin Laden's driver. They were the cook, his cook. A lot of them, they just charged all of them with being bodyguards. And the theory is those were contributions to Al-Qaeda, which is a terrorist organization, and therefore they have provided material support for terrorism. They don't really have any specific acts of terrorism for these guys. And so what they've had to do is charge inchoate crimes. Now, really all of the inchoate crimes are gone, pending a cert petition by the government in this case. And so it's going to be very, very hard to charge anyone now beyond the few who have been charged, who they have specific actual war crimes that, whether they committed them or not, or at least the charges are for actual war crimes. So it's going to restrict who can be charged greatly in the future.
Just to stay on that, and this will get us into the opinions where I think we want to spend most of our time, but as far as completed, I mean, I'm tempted to say co-ate but I don't think that's a word. Completed offenses. The way Balul's conduct was characterized in some of the en banc opinions and also in the dissent was almost to suggest a kind of a retread of the 9/11 case, or kind of an adjunct to the 9/11 case, which is to say that Al-Balul was cast in the clothes of someone who had taken part in a conspiracy that did in fact result in the killings of civilians and the sorts of things that courts have blessed is consistent with these kinds of military tribunals. Are there, in your view, is the government going to try, do you think the government would try to retry Balul at some stage on that theory? I realize, obviously, that you are not privy to any knowledge.
I think that the answer is they can't in the military commissions. Conspiracy is not a standalone war crime. And none of
correct, but there's the 9/11 case where they've amended the charges to say, hey, we're not doing conspiracy qua conspiracy as a crime.
Right.
That's you know, that's out, and we understand that. Or at the time, they didn't put it in those. I'm paraphrasing.
Right.
But they would say, well, there is this thing called joint criminal enterprise. There's a mode of liability for a vicarious liability theory for completed war crimes. You know, and we have a person here who was sort of a lieutenant for bin Laden, worked on the martyr wills for Ziad Jarrah and Muhammad Atta, etc. Is there a sort of completed crime theory in our future, or is this just going to end the case, assuming it doesn't proceed to appellate review of some other kind, which is, I'm sure we'll talk about later.
Well, the only way I see if they want to go forward with that is to try to convert their inchoate conspiracy into aiding and abetting, which is a separate but closely related form of vicarious liability for the acts that were actually committed. The problem is, I think if they had the allegations that they needed to charge him with that, they would have. And because an aider and abettor has to have knowledge of the specific crime or the object of the criminal activity and intend that it occur. Balul was delighted after the fact about 9/11. I think there was no evidence of him having specific knowledge beforehand, so he's not an aider and abettor. I mean, truthfully, all of the 9/11 defendants are charged on an aiding and abetting theory. None of them were in an airplane that crashed into a building and killed people. So if they had that on Balul, they would have charged him, I think. And since if they don't have it, they're out of luck, unless they go to federal courts, where people have been tried for conspiracy, the inchoate crime, for many, 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 many years, including terrorism cases.
You heard it first, Adam Thirschwell. Predicts the repeal of transfer bans to the homeland. That is, of course, there's also no federal appellate review. We're going to get to that in a minute, but I wanted to talk about the opinions and specifically Article 3. The lead opinion, Steve, rests on Article 3 grounds. Exactly what does that mean, and what are the implications for it?
Well, so the Article 3 argument is actually, I think, a bit easy to describe but hard to unpack. And so the premise animating Judge Rogers' opinion for the majority is that Article 3 is the norm, non-Article 3 federal adjudication is the exception, and the Supreme Court has always required some kind of special justification for why we would allow non-Article 3 federal adjudication. There are three categories in which it's been recognized historically: territorial courts, like the D.C. Superior Court, the District Court in Guam, public rights adjudication, so the tax court, the Court of Federal Claims, most administrative agencies, and military courts. So the government says, well, wait a second, this is a military court. Military commissions have been upheld by the Supreme Court before. See, for example, Ex parte Curran, In re Yamashita from World War II. And Judge Rogers says, yes, right, the military commissions have been upheld, but on specific terms, which is to say they were only authorized to try violations of the international laws of war. And that in Curran itself, the court looked to both the extent to which Congress had codified through its Article I power to define and punish offenses against the laws of war, a criminal offense for violating the laws of war, and the extent to which there was an exception to the jury trial rights for, in Chief Justice Stone's words, offenses committed by enemy belligerents against the laws of war. And what Judge Rogers basically says is those precedents don't get the government to the domestic offense of inchoate conspiracy because, as the government itself concedes, inchoate conspiracy is not an international war crime. So the heart of Judge Rogers' Article 3 reasoning is that the court has recognized a limited exception to Article 3 for military commissions, and that the prosecution of Al-Balul for a domestic criminal offense transcends the limits the court has read into those exceptions.
And in terms of the implications, I want to get there. But basically, this drew a major dissent from Judge Henderson.
Certainly a lengthy dissent.
A lengthy dissent. In her view, why does Article 3 allow this to happen?
So I've actually written on Lawfare that I think you can distill the distinction between the majority and dissenting opinions into the sort of longstanding fight between formalism and functionalism when it comes to constitutional analysis, separation of powers especially. Judge Henderson's basic suggestion is that this is close enough to what the Supreme Court has already sanctioned, that these kinds of prosecutions have sanctioned in American history. She looks at, for example, the Lincoln assassination trial after the Civil War, some of the trials from World War II, although I think those are debatable precedents. And she says, you know, we should give Congress deference when it comes to these kinds of war powers questions. You know, maybe it's not sort of a perfect situation, but it's close enough. And that if we are going to be pragmatic about this and apply a functional analysis and look at the kind of guy Al-Balul is, and look at the rights that he probably, you know, doesn't have in Henderson's view as a non-citizen outside the United States, from Henderson's perspective, the departure from Article 3 is awfully modest, and one that, by her reasoning, compares to prior departures the Supreme Court has allowed in other contexts.
On that point, the whole, basically the logic of it is slippery slope, that eventually that you're, what you're having is this Congress essentially parking Article 3 functions in other places to the detriment of the ordinary federal system. And they say, well, if you can do this without any limiting principle, you can throw any offense in there.
And that's the problem with that reasoning is that that's exactly the critique that's been leveled at the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in the public rights context. So, you know, since 1986 even, the Supreme Court has taken this kind of functionalist approach to the public rights branch of non-Article III adjudication, notwithstanding the very slippery slope argument you've just mentioned. Justice Brennan would keep dissenting and saying, what about this, you know, when Article III is concerned, the first step down a slippery slope is often the last one. And the court has embraced that in the public rights context. But, and I think this is where I think Judge Henderson's dissent fails to persuade, the public rights context is different from this context in two critical respects. First, those are all civil claims. And indeed, most of those are civil claims arising under state law, where it's not as if you're taking away power from federal judges, you're actually taking away power from state judges. And second, those aren't criminal prosecutions, right, where you have the full concerns about the judge, the jury, the procedural protections that apply to a criminal process. The Supreme Court has never suggested that this kind of functional analysis is the right methodology to take in a criminal prosecution. And I think that's part of why Judge Rogers' resort to formalism makes more sense.
Let me ask you two things about it. You both feel free to react to this. So if you're using the Henderson reasoning on Article 3, I just want to sort of tease out, sort of say, look at what she's looking at and see how much it makes sense. If the fear is that, you know, you'll have this encroachment on Article 3, and we're worried about, oh, you know, they'll make credit card fraud a military commission. They'll subject credit card fraud or false statements to that. Wouldn't we have seen that by now? She says in her dissent, for example, she says, for example, hey, this isn't that big of an encroachment. These are Article III judges. They just happen to get involved in the game a little bit later on.
So I think there are two reactions to that. I'm sure Adam has his own as well. But the first is, it would certainly prove too much if Article III appellate review were all that was necessary to justify non-Article III adjudication. Because that would mean that basically you would never need an Article III trial court for any federal question at all.
Right. But in the trials below, you do in fact have, if you take the trajectory of the military commission's procedures since the president's military order, what you have seen is, you know, the application of more and more, the narrowing of the government's room to maneuver and get up to trickery, more trial procedures that more and more resemble courts.
Right, it's certainly the case that the that
so it's not that it's not sort of throw up and just have an Article III judge look at it.
But what the Supreme Court has historically worried about in this context is that Congress might be giving what Justice O'Connor called the essential attributes of judicial power to non-Article III tribunals. And so in the public rights context, the court hasn't been so worried about, for example, allowing the Commodities Futures Trading Commission to entertain a counterclaim under state law to reparations proceeding, because that's not exactly the bread and butter of what federal judges do. Here, in contrast, you are taking a conspiracy charge, which, you know, is a pretty broad criminal offense, far broader than any other offenses the military commissions are allowed to try, and you're giving the power to try it to a military judge, who is not protected by Article 3, the salary and tenure protections, who does not have the same kind of experience presiding over these kinds of wholly domestic prosecutions, right? And you're saying this is, you know, run with the ball. And I think that's exactly...
Look at the facts on the ground. If you see these judges performing... Are these real? And just in terms of what's actually happened, I think I'm sort of playing Henderson in my mind here, observing the judges are being more.
So Ballul's case, I think, is a great example of this. I mean, taking Ballul's case specifically, right? The trial judge in Ballul's case and in Hamdan's case laughed basically out of order the claim that these crimes weren't international war crimes, which was the government's initial argument, right? The initial claim was these actually are international war crimes, so therefore no problem trying them. And the trial court said,
I think Henderson actually takes that position too, I heard it said.
And the trial court said, of course, that's right. And then the Court of Military Commission Review, after taking 2 years to decide, unanimously affirms that, right? So in the military commission system, there is not a single critical voice suggesting, oh, wait a second, maybe these aren't actually international war crimes.
But you do have judges saying, no, that is unlawful influence. Stop.
Yeah, well, that's...
You do have judges saying, no, hold on. If you want to interfere with these defense teams, I do not sanction that, and we're going to look into this.
That is true. But I think that proves the problem. I mean, there is no comparable principle in federal court criminal prosecutions to unlawful influence. I mean, the doctrine of unlawful influence applies in military courts because of the recurrent problem of commanders interfering and with tilting the balance, usually against the defendant, in these military prosecutions. And that is absolutely, the judges have said on a few occasions in this case, one of the five or six or seven motions claiming unlawful influence have been filed in the 9/11 case and Nashery, they have often, but not always, said, yes, that was unlawful influence. What they haven't done is give you a remedy that a federal judge might grant. I mean, where there is blatant interference, and it sounds small, but it's quite big. The most recent foo-for-ah was when the DOD decided, the secretary or undersecretary who handles these things, decided, hey, these cases aren't moving fast enough. Let's make the judges live on the Navy base instead of getting to go home every now and then because, oh boy, nobody wants to go to Guantanamo. So they'll get these cases over with as fast as possible.
That'll sure teach those judges a lesson.
That'll teach it. And so, absolutely, the judges...
And what happened when they tried that?
Well, the judges all found that that was unlawful influence since it touched their own interest. It was very funny. Judge Pohl wrote the longest and most complex opinion of his tenure in this case on that issue. But they were, you know, and one of the judges said disqualified the whole convening authority and who had participated in that decision and these members of his office who had been involved from further participation in the Nashery case. But Judge Pohl didn't go that far, he just basically ordered the instruction, military instruction regulation, revoked. Okay, so put aside Nashery for a moment. He would have stopped the problem, but the people who deliberately and consciously tried to influence his behavior in that case would have remained in positions of tremendous power over the both the defense and the prosecution, and that would not happen in federal court.
And just to put a ribbon on it, I mean, I think that the key point here is the Supreme Court Article 3 jurisprudence is not about whether in this one specific case did the non-Article 3 adjudicator do things pretty well, because if that were the standard, this jurisprudence would make no sense at all. Right? The Supreme Court's non-Article 3 jurisprudence is about whether looking at this system as a whole. Do we have concerns that Congress has given too much of the judicial power to an institution that doesn't look like us? And the reason why that's the concern is twofold. One, we trust that institution less. But two, we worry that Congress, whether we trust the other institution more, is therefore affirmatively undermining the Article III courts, right? That Congress is actually telling the Article III courts, we don't want you in the middle of this. We want this other institution, whatever its warts, whatever its strengths, be handled on this. And that's the problem that the Supreme Court has always worried about in this context. That's why so many of the court's cases take a different approach when the litigant has consented to being placed into that system versus in this context where they've never consented.
Let me ask you both something about the system as a whole. A great point of dispute as between Judge Henderson and, so I gather, between Judge Tatel, who wrote this concurrence, explaining Judge Tatel, you know, wrote this concurrence where he basically explained why he had previously voted to sustain Balow's conviction, but now, because of the more intrusive or sort of sweeping and searching review done by the appellate court, had voted to overturn it. He also they both got into a discussion of what the Article III holding would mean for our system of government and international law. Tatel points out and says, well, look, this doesn't mean Congress can't be forward-leaning in defining war crimes. It doesn't at all. What it means is when they want to be forward-leaning, when they want to get out and maybe get out a little in front of the international community, they can do that. But they have to do it in federal court first. And Henderson, in the beginning of her dissent, says, yeah, and that's really bad, because that means we wait, and then the international community gets a vote, and then who gets to sort of decide whether it's all okay later? Federal judges. So they both don't like it. My question for both of you are, what are the merits and demerits of that system? Because just practically speaking, we'll be, or many suspect we will be, in a state of armed conflict with somebody and adjudicating rights under the laws of international laws of war for some time to come. And does it make sense to have the battleground in the first instance always be federal courts? And if so, why? Or if not, why not?
So, let me go out on a limb and say I think the answer is that it does make sense, and I've written multiple law review articles arguing that it does make sense, and when folks are really, you know, in desperate need of somnolent inducing reading, they should refer to that scholarship. Here's why I think it makes sense. Congress is generally entitled to deference. I mean, I think that's, you know, there's a presumption of constitutionality. We assume that when Congress acts, even this Congress, that what it's doing is legitimate. But part of why Congress is entitled to the presumption of constitutionality and to this deference is because we assume that it's our ordinary civilian institutions that are serving as the check on Congress, right? So, you know, Commerce Clause jurisprudence in the Supreme Court. Congress gets some deference, not unlimited deference, right? And it's the courts who decide. In the context of the Define and Punish Clause, which is the Article I power at the heart of this whole controversy, I agree with, I think, both Judge Tatel and Judge Henderson that Congress is entitled to some deference when it comes to defining what the law of nations is and, therefore, what the punishment should be for violating it. The problem is I don't agree that that deference travels into a military court, right? That there's, at that point, there are competing constitutional pressures that seem to me to militate against giving Congress the deference that in a civilian court I think they'd be entitled to. And I think a good example is, I mean, look at like the Bond case from the Supreme Court from last year about whether Congress was entitled to deference in how it implemented the Chemical Weapons Convention. You know, I actually think Congress is entitled to deference. I think Bond, you know, is a pretty close case. Why is the court worried about it? Because there's a competing constitutional principle, in Bond's case, federalism, right, pushing back against the deference during the leg of Congress. So in this context, I think Congress should get deference in the civilian courts because there is no competing constitutional principle pushing back against that deference. In the military courts, I think there are two competing constitutional principles. One is the right to an Article III judge, and the other is a right to a jury. And it's those two, I think, forces that explain why we shouldn't defer to Congress in the military context, and why if Congress is going to lead the way in international law, as is its right, it should be civilian courts where they set those precedents.
And if I can just chime in from a different angle, the angle of the law of war, there is a, you know, tremendous theoretical apparatus explaining the justifications for the law of war, and in fact they've changed a great deal over history. But the current primary one is that you need a law of war to keep both sides in check. And that means the mutual responsibilities, obligations, and limits have to be mutual on both sides. And I think that mutuality is very, very hard to maintain under the political pressures of wartime. The 9/11 experience is a great example, where after 9/11, there was an understandable tremendous fears and tremendous hatred of the people who we believed had done these things. And so the political branches both arguably dramatically overstepped what would be an acceptable practices under the law of war. And of course, torture is the leading example. And the political branches are going to be subject to those pressures responsive to those pressures to a greater extent than a life tenured Article III judge. The Article III judges have traditionally caved to a great extent during these times of political crisis, but they have also been the branch that is capable and actually has eventually pushed back historically. And I just, One example is Judge Tatel's concurrence in Ballul. And another, frankly, is the Second Circuit's, the end of the Second Circuit's opinion yesterday in Turkmen.
What happened in this case?
In Turkmen was a case about the detention, the broad brush detention of Muslim men who were in technical minor violation of various immigration laws that occurred in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And these were basically the highest DOJ officials and FBI officials authorized a sweep of young Muslim men and people who they thought were Muslim but weren't actually.
Whether or not they could connect those guys to
yeah, the 9/11 attacks. It was just they were in technical violation. They had some legal basis for detention because there was a minor violation of the immigration rules, and detained them in often in solitary confinement under horrendous conditions that we impose on the worst of the worst in our federal prison system, and so this lawsuit was a suit by them for constitutional violations of their rights in the course of that sweep. And they brought the suit in 2003 or something. It was a very long time ago. And they have lost and lost, minor victories, reversed, gone back. Finally, the Second Circuit just sustained their right to bring constitutional claims on the basis of their treatment. And this is a very dramatic opinion in the context of the way the federal courts have treated kind of 9/11, post-9/11 issues generally. I mean, it was a pushback from the court, and it was an explicit pushback. Justice Tatel said, look, you're going to potentially turn every bit of the federal code into a federal criminal code into something that can be tried in a military court if you follow Judge Henderson's lead in the dissent. The Second Circuit closed with a quite eloquent pan to the rule of law, and specifically in the context of national security. And so, should these cases be in federal court? I would say yes, from that larger historical experience, from the perspective of the laws of war. At least the judiciary eventually resists the political pressure to do the wrong thing.
And this is, I think, going to be perhaps the most important point to take away from this whole military commission's experience, which is, we don't have to speculate. I mean, we've had, the better part of 13 plus years now of some kind of military commission program. What's their track record been? I mean, when it comes to, have the military commission shown that these judges can be trusted to appropriately grapple with important constitutional and statutory questions of first impression? Have they shown that the judges can be, trusted to correctly anticipate what their appellate brethren are going to say if and when these issues get up to the appellate courts? The answers to both questions are resounding no's. And so we might be able to point to isolated episodes where the military commission trial judges have pushed back, especially when it's their convenience that's been implicated. But I don't know that anyone can point to the track record of the commissions as vindicating the claim of Judge Henderson's dissent and Judge Kavanaugh's concurrence in the en banc opinion last summer that we should let the military commission, that we should trust the military commissions. If anything, whatever one thinks of the legality of the commissions, I don't know how you can look at the last 13 years as an exercise that should have built trust in anything other than that when these cases get to the D.C. Circuit, the government's actually going to lose more often than it wins.
That actually brings us to the sort of next phase, apropos this case, and this is a podcast about al-Ballul, but maybe it applies with some force to Turkmen as well. It's not the end of this case. There remains the question.
Well, that's up to the government.
Well, that's up to the government. Briefly, just both of you, let's run through the appellate possibilities here. What are possible outcomes? What are likely outcomes?
Well, so, I mean, formally, the government has two choices. I guess it has three choices. One is to pack up and go home. I would not, if I were a betting man, put a whole lot of money on that option. The second is to seek rehearing en banc. But given the composition of this panel in particular, I just don't know where the votes are. I mean, the government, of course, could try just to sort of run out the clock a bit and keep this process going. But certainly, if the question is whether they have a good chance of getting 6 of the 11 active judges of the D.C. Circuit to take this case en banc, I wouldn't be optimistic even if I were the government. And that leaves going for cert. And I think this has been, for the better part of 3.5 years since the D.C. Circuit's decision in Hamdan 2, this has been the question, which is the government eventually going to take this issue to the Supreme Court? And we've been led to believe that there is an internal fight within the executive branch about this exact posture question. with the National Security Division and the Solicitor General's office on opposite sides. The rubber is about to hit the road, because I think this is what it comes down to. Will the government seek cert? If they do, I think it's worth reminding everyone that the government has sought cert 5 times in post 9/11 terrorism cases. The Supreme Court has obliged 5 times, and although I don't think this will hold an albalul, in all 5 of those cases, the Supreme Court reversed the lower court decision inside.
Let me ask you about that. It's one thing to ask for the Supreme Court's review, confident in your case that you will win on the merits, but that assumes something about the legal theory that you're taking to the Supreme Court for review in the first place. I want to ask Adam this because I think it would probably make his head explode just to sort of jump into the role of a prosecutor. So I will ask you, what if you're sitting there and you believe this case warrants review by the justices and you want to persuade them, what route are you going to take? Before you answer, this is what I have in mind. So far as I know, I may be wrong, and I'll let you guys correct me, but I think there was accord between the parties about the forfeitability of structural challenges. So there was always this thing like in the en banc, you could always take it up and say, oopsie-daisy, you forfeited your argument. But at this stage, if I'm correct, it would be awkward now to say, oh, never mind. Can this really be forfeited? Let's find out. Maybe you did forfeit, goodbye. So then there's that. But then you have the question of conspiracy as an offense, which is a long-litigated sort of evergreen issue for the commission system, which comes down to Anthony Kennedy. And is, although he's a tough nut to crack from a sort of appellate prediction standpoint, I think it's safe to assume that his prior writings do not exactly point to a resounding victory for the United States. So, you know, you're in the Solicitor General's office. You're sort of weighing these equities. What theory would you begin to trot out, both to get cert and win, draw five or more votes?
So, I mean, especially if I'm worried about the merits, I might gravitate toward the majority's holding that the structural Article III question isn't waivable and the standard of review. But there's a problem there. There's a sort of a Pandora's box, because if the government takes this case to the Supreme Court on the question of whether the Article III issue can't be forfeited, well, then presumably the question of whether the other issues that were resolved by the en banc court could be forfeited, and indeed were forfeited, would also have to go to the Supreme Court. And so this would become a huge mush over what Albalul will actually forfeit and what he can forfeit. I can't imagine that if the government's claim is this is a really important case that the Supreme Court desperately has to work out, leading with this one defendant forfeited his claims is actually a convincing way to make that case. So I really do think if the government takes this up, they're going to take it up on the merits. And then the question really becomes, which of two theories do they push? Is the theory that, in fact, Henderson's right, we really should take a functional approach to this question and defer to Congress and accept that this kind of offense is not that far removed from the kinds of offenses that military commissions have historically tried, that this is not that great of an incursion upon Article III? Or do they launch a full frontal assault on conspiracy as a war crime? And say, listen, you know, we're not trying to expand the precedents the Supreme Court already has. We're trying to say this fits within those precedents. Conspiracy is not that radically different from the kinds of offenses the Supreme Court in Kieran allowed a military commission to try. Those are different kinds of arguments, and I think those could play differently with different of the justices. But I gotta say, if I'm a handicapping person and I read Justice Kennedy's concurrence in Hamdan 1, I'm not sure why either of those theories would be likely to persuade. And I think that's where I end up. Yeah.
And if I can chime in again from a different angle.
Well, chime away.
I think to put this decision by the government in context, I mean, up to now, the government has been trying to defend a conviction against an individual defendant who everyone agrees is a bad guy, blah, 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 and preserve that conviction. At the point where the government has to decide whether to seek cert or not, it's a very different position they're in. The government does not seek cert to preserve a conviction
of one guy.
It seeks cert to decide an issue that it believes of general or, you know, high significance to the country as a whole in some cases. This is one of these cases. So what I see from the prosecutor's perspective, the government's perspective, the decision they have to make, is the Department of Justice, this administration, going to try to get the Supreme Court to enable Congress and the executive to collude to bring ordinary crimes, virtually any ordinary crime, if it has some nexus to warfare, into military courts. Or to put it in a shorter and probably not entirely, I mean, a shorter way, is the government going to try to get the Supreme Court to potentially militarize our criminal justice system? And that's what's at stake. And that has nothing to do with the law. I mean, what that has to do with is the political question of how do you view the role of government and the judiciary in the most important issues that can be decided about individuals' lives, which is to say whether they're free, imprisoned, or executed. And I think the decision is more political than it is legal, agreeing with every single thing that Steve has said along the way. That's how I look at this.
And then I think the real question becomes, do the conservatives vote to grant cert without knowing where Kennedy is? Because if ever there was a case, a post 9/11 national security case, and here I would draw a sharp distinction with Turkmen, where I could see the Supreme Court denying cert even at the government's request, this might be it. Where it's not an issue that transcends other jurisdictions, where it's not a constitutional question that's going to have implications beyond the specific context of military commissions, you know, it wouldn't strike me as being preposterous if, even if the government asks for cert, this is the first time the Supreme Court actually says, no, we're good. You know, if you live with the D.C. Circuit, you die by the D.C. Circuit.
All the more so where the consequences on the ground for the key case in that commission system, the chief prosecutor is saying it can go forward without this.
Well, I think, and in that regard, I mean, I think, you know, by the time, I mean, the justices read the newspaper, and I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, General Martins has himself acknowledged, albeit, you know, in documents that I think weren't initially meant to be public, that they envision no more than 7 additional prosecutions beyond the 3 that are currently underway. That is to say, the 9/11 trial, Nashiri, although to say that Nashiri is underway is an interesting assessment of momentum.
It's still on a docket of a court within the commission system.
True, and the Hadi al-Iraqi case. So, you know, the question I think really becomes just how much is at stake for the government here. You know, yes, as Adam says, 3 or 4 of the convictions have become vulnerable if this stands, but, you know, several of those guys are already home and released, so that's, you know, this won't in any way, one way or the other, affect the 9/11 case. It won't affect Nashiri, which has plenty of its own problems. It'll affect one of the charges in Hadi al-Iraqi, but not both of them, right? And it's not clear how many of the 7 hypothetical future. So I'm not sure at the end of the day that this is actually, that the stakes are so high for the government that they can make that the political case to the justices. You know, I've been wrong before. I mean, this is you know, it's easy to see why the court would take this case anyway. But it's worth stressing that the last time the Supreme Court had to deal with military commissions, the government lost big. I mean, Hamdan may not have been a constitutional case, but man, was it a smacking rejoinder. And I don't know that the government's going to be particularly excited about the prospect of giving this court a chance to look at the Military Commissions Act, which the last time the court looked at it was Boumediene, and that didn't go particularly well either.
Gentlemen, Adam Thirschwell of the Military Commission, Steve Vladek of American University, Chess, Security, and Lawfare. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I guess we'll be back for Obelul 4.
Stay tuned.
And 5.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare podcast via your social networks, Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any way you can. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.